Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. On the show today, we'll have another conversation with a candidate for office in our part of the state. In the run-up to primaries and also to general election, we try as much as we can to have candidates on the program to give you the opportunity to talk with them. Reporters get to talk with them all the time. But the idea of these programs is to give some citizen and voter access to candidates, and that's why we do them. The guest today is Tim Johnson. He is a Republican candidate who is running for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. Now, this is an open seat, as some months ago, Tom Ewing decided that he was going to retire. So we have two candidates here, Republican and Democrat. His opponent in this race is Mike Kelleher. He was here on the program a couple of weeks ago, and we're glad to have Tim Johnson here to give you the same opportunity to talk with the candidate. He has, for a number of years now, since 1976, been a member of the Illinois House of Representatives. And in the House, he has served as a Deputy Majority Leader. He's also been a floor spokesman for the House Republicans and has been a member of the House Republican leadership team. Also, before that, before being elected to the State House, he served on the Urbana City Council for a number of years. He also was, between 1990 and 96, the Republican County Chairman for Champaign County. So he has been involved in politics in our area for quite a long time. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois. He went to both undergraduate school here and got his law degree here, and he also makes his living as an attorney in Urbana. We're glad to have him here, and if you would like to call in and talk, you're certainly welcome to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line, so that means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. And again, if you match the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL 333 WILL toll free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much,
Dave. I'm glad to be here. It's been a little while now. This is always one of the best forums of any year, and particularly in election year, is your station and your reach and the depth of issue that people bring to me.
Very good. Well, again, I hope so. We'll get some calls from people. Well, I can ask some questions in the meantime. Let's talk about Social Security and Medicare, since these are subjects that certainly on the presidential level have been much discussed. Some people have voiced concern about the future of Social Security, whether or not the system will continue to stay solvent, and whether or not we should make some changes in the way the Social Security operates, including the possibility of giving individuals the opportunity to take some of the money that now just goes into the system and make some decisions for themselves on investing that. Do you think that we should be changing the way that Social Security is structured?
Well, clearly, contrary to what some have said, the system is partially broken and needs to be fixed. Estimates range as to the year when the system will start operating in the red, but under current circumstances, it will within the next couple decades. And estimates range anywhere from 2 decades to 4 as to when it will be defunct, but clearly, unless we make a change, that'll happen. It is essential, Dave, without sounding trite, that we keep the commitment that we made to individuals who've paid into this system for all or part of a lifetime to have a secure retirement. That system is jeopardized. That system is under besiegement. It is my feeling, among other things, that both Medicare and Social Security need to be taken off budget. With the budget surplus that now exists, we need to put, and I hate to use the word, but we want a better word, both Social Security and Medicare in a lockbox. Take it off budget and assure that that's our first priority, to keep those commitments. It is also my position that there should be a voluntary option on the part of current payers into the system to dedicate a portion of their savings into personal savings accounts that are pre-approved and safe, and that will ultimately mean that the system will be sounder and that those individuals receive a greater return on their investment. And that's good for everybody.
Hmm. The thing I think that some people are concerned about is that if we're worried about the soundness of the system, aren't we taking a risk by taking some of the money that would go into the system to pay benefits out and giving it to people, in a sense, giving it to people and say, here, you can invest this on your own?
Well, first of all, part of the benefit of this program is to assure the underlying strength of the system, and that's done by allowing individual annuitants to be able to receive a greater return on their investment, and therefore less pressure on the system generally. But an integral part of the proposal that Governor Bush has made, that Speaker Hastert has made, would be paying back into the Treasury the large amounts of money that have been borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund to be able to more than cover those amounts of money that people optionally put into personal savings accounts. And it seems to me that the overall system is protected, individuals are protected, and that a system that is absolutely essential to a humane society and to one that keeps its promises will be secure. Now, that said, when we talk about Medicare, you raise Medicare too. Mm-hmm. And we have honest philosophical disagreements. One of the points that my opponent has made, one of the planks of his platform, and I certainly respect his right to make these proposals, but I strongly disagree, is that the age for Medicare, in his judgment, should be lowered to 55. I'm almost 55. I shouldn't be able to receive Medicare. The ultimate effect of lowering that age to 55, you know, why not lower it to 45 or 35 or 25, would be to seriously undermine the financial actuarial stability of the Medicare and Social Security system. And so that's simply an area that we have a major disagreement on. And while I strongly support measures to shore up this system, to cut waste, to provide alternatives, to make sure that the Medicare and Social Security system work, that we extend Medicare to cover prescription medication, that expansion of the benefits of the sort that he's talking about, namely lowering the Medicare age to 55, just doesn't make financial sense.
Mm-hmm. It seems that I think in some people's minds, doing that, lowering the age at which we'll provide Medicare to people and looking at providing greater health coverage for children is a way of, in small bites, getting to the point that some people would like to see us, and that is universal health coverage.
Sure. My opponent was a staffer for Congressman Russo, Congressman Marty Russo, for two or three years. Congressman Russo was the author of Hillary Clinton's universal health care proposal. I happen to believe that that is not a direction that serves the general public, and it certainly doesn't serve individuals within our society. It provides a huge cost to the taxpayers, and it provides a poorer quality medical service. And I don't believe that we ought to incrementally head towards an universal health care system. At the same time, I believe there are a number of gaps, David, that need to be filled in terms of, at the state level, our CHIPS program, the federal program, various funding for Alzheimer's, for Parkinson's, for cancer, with respect to prescription medication, our agenda for Healthy America that would cover prescription medication for those within the Medicare system. I believe those are sound programs that involve both the public and the private sector that will work well. But I think the radical changes that Mr. Russo proposed some decades ago, or that some individuals propose today, simply don't make sense.
Just like to remind people, maybe you've tuned in the last little bit here, our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is Tim Johnson. He's a Republican candidate for Congress in Illinois' 15th District, and is here not just to talk with me, but also to talk with you. And if you have questions, there's a particular issue that concerns you, whatever is most important to you, call in and talk with him about it.
And when I leave here, between here and Impey, where I'm going to take a swim, I'm stopping at Cafe Espresso Royale on campus. So if anybody wants to see me and they don't want to call in, just stop, and I'll stop in there and say hello to people.
All right. We can't promise he'll buy you coffee, but...
Oh, I won't do that.
Say hello. 333-333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Well, maybe we should talk a little bit about prescription drug coverage. It's something that both Republicans and Democrats are talking about, but they have different approaches. How would you see this working?
Well, mine, David, is a variation both from the Gore and the Bush proposal. I would extend prescription medication to all individuals without cost who live within 135% of the poverty level. From 135 to 150% of the poverty level, we have a graded scale that provides a very, very low cost. I would provide a $6,000 ceiling for anyone beyond which their costs can never extend, which, along with these other things, provides the incentive for the private sector given the lack of the possibility of catastrophic loss, to be involved and to make a cost-efficient delivery of services for people over 150% of the poverty level, where we provide them the option of either a higher premium, which would be obviously result in a lower deductible, mm-hmm. or a lower premium and a higher deductible, and the option of combining that in tandem with a private coinsurance program that would provide the delivery of those services that are necessary and really address, I think, in a pretty four-square way, the spiraling cost of prescription medication. And there's no question, as I go from Kankakee to Paris and Champaign to Bloomington, that the spiraling cost of prescription medication is a big issue. And I would just say parenthetically, I know this doesn't address directly that issue, that there are some who believe that if this Justice Department has the capacity and the will to pursue Bill Gates for real or alleged violations of antitrust laws, then that perhaps that same examination ought to be directed to the big pharmaceutical companies who some allege anyway are involved in tying agreements or antitrust violations or otherwise.
Mm. Well, that indeed gets to the issue that I thought I might raise with you. Just when we talk about the cost of drugs, some people have indeed said that perhaps the government ought to, if not intervene, at least ought to look at the issue of pricing. And I guess as I think of you as pretty much a guy who believes in a limited role of government, and it surprises me to hear you say, well, maybe that's something that we ought to be thinking about.
Well, I guess, David, my concept of limited government goes back to the Teddy Roosevelt approach, and that is that a true free market system, a true enterprise system can't work if you have monopolistic practices. That's not free enterprise. That's just a transferred form of corporate socialism of its own sort. And so I would suggest that it's entirely in keeping with a limited government approach to say that that when you have tying agreements, when you have antitrust violations, when you have anti-competitive combinations, that works very contrary, exactly contrary, to the system of free enterprise that I think has worked well for this country for decades.
Mm. Just to ask one more question about the prescription drug program that you outlined, what's this going to cost, do you think?
We don't have exact estimates on the cost. We know that our cost is the cost of this program is substantially less than the Gore proposal, and at least as little as or less than the Bush proposal. But we haven't been able, because of the lack of government statistics, to get you exact figures. But it's certainly within the range of affordability.
You talked about the fact that you would like to see more money go into research on things like cancer and Alzheimer's disease and so forth. I think that some people believe, at least, that there's a great need to provide long-term care, and that it's unfortunate that people would have to get to the point where they would have to spend all of their assets and then rely on public assistance at the end of their life to take care of their needs, particularly if what we're talking about is custodial care. Do you think that there's any possibility that we might get to the point that there would be an expanded coverage under Medicare for long-term care?
There have been those proposals. In fact, I think one of the proposals at least parallels that was one that was made by former Speaker Newt Gingrich. And there have been those proposals, and I agree with the underlying assumption that it's an issue that we need to address. And I think that this next Congress and the following Congresses will have the opportunity to look at that at more length and determine what parameters a long-term care program should encompass.
Mm-hmm. I think when you look at those lists of subjects, they go out and they talk to voters and they say, well, what's most important to you? One of the things that seems to be near the top of everybody's list, education. What can be done to strengthen public education? And what, if any, the role of the federal government should be? I think people do believe that schools are and should be locally governed institutions. That certainly Republicans talk about that a good deal. But certainly Mr. Bush also has talked about a federal role in education. And I wonder how it is one reconciles those two notions when you say, you know, we have locally elected school boards, they are local institutions, yet there is some kind of federal government role. What is that role?
I don't mean to be evasive about the question because it's well put, but I think it's hard to answer that question without making some reference to the role of the state government in the whole ingredient. Mm. And it's also probably impossible to answer completely without talking about higher education. So give me a little leash here, and I'll
sure.
do that.
Sure.
We've begun to finally turn the corner after many years of decreasing percentage of state dollars going into education. We finally began to turn the corner. We're still not adequately funding education. I supported and broke with my party several years ago in supporting the Edgar Education Package, would have essentially shifted the funding from real estate to an income tax, the means by which we fund schools. I still strongly support that. I have been a strong committee to elementary and secondary and higher education. I suppose that's one of the reasons why I've been endorsed by the National Education Association, the Illinois Education Association. And I believe that the federal government can play a role at higher educational level, through obviously in a major way, through grants to this institution, to ISU and others, hugely important to the future of this community, the University of Illinois. Federal dollars are critical. There are as many federal dollars coming in here as there are state dollars, other than tuition sources and so forth, Pell Grants, and then special needs with respect to elementary and secondary level, special education needs, various disability grants, and others filling in the gaps, and I think that's appropriate that be done. But I do agree with Governor Bush when he says, that the decision is how best to use those dollars is not reached in a one-size-fits-all mentality, but rather in the Unit 116 or Unit 7 schools in terms of their determinations of how dollars ought to be spent. Let me just say one last thing about education before we go on. I've represented this community for 28 years, including my years in the City Council, but 24 years in the General Assembly. And together with Stan Weaver and with Virgil Wyckoff, with Helen Satterthwaite, with Rick Winkle, with Laurel Prussing, we have been absolutely dedicated to this university and its role as a preeminent national institution across the board. In my opinion, we've got one of the finest institutions of higher education in the world right here. But as we go into this new millennium, and we go into the biotechnological revolution, as we deal with an unlimited landscape of new technological advances, we've got to assure that this university is on the cutting edge. And I make no apologies about going to Washington and having one of my primary missions to assure that ISU and the University of Illinois receive every dollar that we can get in terms of research and otherwise to make sure that higher education, which is with agriculture the backbone of this district, is supported to the hilt. And I would suggest to you that if we don't do that successfully, if we don't have somebody here advocating successfully for the future of higher education in Central Illinois, then the socioeconomic system that we've learned to live with and love could be something very different than what we expect and have today.
Just to talk a little bit specifically about elementary secondary education.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to digress.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I think that I hear from some people this concern that government, and I guess they're talking about the federal government, is somehow intruding on the way schools are run. And given the fact that, as we acknowledge, that schools are governed by local folks, locally elected, and given the fact that the federal government, as far as elementary and secondary education goes, doesn't provide a lot of money, I guess my question is, all right, to those people who say that government is too intrusive, what exactly does that mean? Do you think that there are ways in which the federal government is too involved in telling schools, elementary, secondary schools, what to do?
There are areas where the Department of Education, as well as the State Board of Education through grants from Springfield, imposes mandates on units of local government, specifically school districts, without dollars attached. And I think that in those particular areas, and in other areas of micromanaging in the gamut of issues, I think that's an inappropriate federal role. On the other hand, I think we can look back to the 1960s when Governor Wallace stood on the courthouse steps and attempted to prevent African Americans from entering institutions of higher education or other than their, quote, own schools in Alabama. And I think when local control denigrates to a level of violating clear constitutional mandates and rights, there are those areas where the federal or state government need to be involved. But for the most part, and on an everyday basis and on a micromanagement basis, I don't believe that the federal government has or should have much of a role in terms of how to run the Blue Ridge School District or the Ridgeview School District.
These days, I think when it comes to public education, and again, I'm thinking about what happens on elementary and secondary levels, accountability is one of the big words that everybody talks about. And states, I think, have tried to respond to that desire. Certainly, Illinois and Indiana have, and I'm sure other states have as well, by instituting standardized testing. You test in certain subjects at various times along the child's career to be able to say to parents and to the public, here's how we're doing. Is there some need for doing that on the national level?
I'm not sure that there's a need. I think there's a need for establishing the basic proposition that students who graduate from institutions of education in the United States ought to have certain learned skills, and that there ought to be a certain level of accountability. But the problem is, while I voted for Chicago school reform and other reform measures at the state level, one size within the state, let alone within the nation, does not fit all. The other problem is, David, and I've had countless numbers of administrators and teachers, and for that matter, parents and students, who've come to me and said, these tests are okay, but they change every year. We establish a testing system that disrupts our whole workday for 3 days, and then the next year it's completely different. And the consistency in terms of administrative bodies is implementation of what's a good concept has not been there. And so I believe accountability ought to exist. I believe that there ought to be requisite requirements for schools in terms of the product that they produce. But I think it can be better produced on a case-by-case or at least district-by-district level with certain basic governing parameters than some kind of a national or a state one-size-fits-all approach.
We're about midway through here. We have a caller we'll get right to. And again, I'd like to introduce again our guest for the show. We're talking with Tim Johnson. He has since 1976 served in the Illinois House of Representatives. He's a Republican and now is running for Congress in the 15th District here in the state. His opponent is Mike Kelleher. He was here on this program a couple of weeks ago, and we wanted to have you get the same opportunity to hear from Tim Johnson and to ask questions. You can do that very easily by calling us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455.
I might add, Dave, that the hot tea that's just been provided me by your station is the best I've had in days. I really appreciate it.
We'll see if we can get you a refill.
That's my drink of choice.
We'll work on that. Here's a caller to talk with in Urbana. It's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to the Social Security issue, if I may. I wondered what the candidate would think of the idea of raising or eliminating the cap on the amount of earnings that are taxed for Social Security, which I believe is around $60,000 or so now. This could have the effect of, as well as making the Social Security system more secure than relying on a stock market that's been going up and down a lot lately, possibly making the system more fair so that working people who earn under that amount don't have to pay, say, twice as much or 10 times as much as people in a percentage terms of their income to Social Security as people earn a lot more.
Are you suggesting that the rate of tax for rate of Social Security tax? I'm not sure what you're suggesting.
That the limit. I believe that only the first $60,000 or so of one's earnings are taxed for Social Security right now.
I mean, once you're of a Social Security age.
No, I'm talking.
I see what you're saying. For anyone, I see what you're saying.
Payroll tax.
That same limitation does not apply to Medicare, by the way.
No, I'm talking about just Social Security.
Right.
So there have been ideas to raise that amount or eliminate the cap so that, say, $120,000 would be taxed for Social Security or all of one's income, no matter how much it was.
Well, that's certainly a proposal.
Rate, so I wonder what.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, that's certainly been a proposal that's been made. The underlying assumption since the 1930s is that Social Security is a retirement program and not a tax. There are some who have suggested, in fact, one of my professors in law school who suggested, let's just discard the concept that this is a retirement program, is treated as a tax and act accordingly. And it would seem to me that if we head towards the increasing the income limits at which Social Security applies beyond where it is now, we are going a long ways towards calling it a tax. I'd be glad to look at that issue, but I guess my first inclination is to say that with respect to the payments made into the system, it works well the way it exists now. I'm not no one has specifically asked me that, and that's a very good question. That certainly goes to some of the actuarial underpinnings of the system. But I guess I'm inclined to believe that while we shouldn't extend benefits, neither should we extend taxes beyond where they are now.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that you have advocated, and I think certainly other Republicans have as well, is the elimination of inheritance tax.
The estate tax. Right?
Pardon me, yes.
We eliminated the Illinois inheritance tax.
Indeed. My misstatement, indeed, the estate tax. The concern particularly, I think, focuses here on small business people and farmers.
Right.
Because, in fact, the number of estates that qualify in this country are relatively small. And sometime soon, I guess it's next year, I believe that it'll get to the point where you can have an estate of $1 million and not pay any tax at all. So here we're talking about, in some sense, some special cases. Why eliminate the estate tax completely rather than, say, do something like simply raise the point at which we're going to say below this level we won't expect any tax at all?
Well, that's certainly one proposal. I would suggest, however, that first of all, my opponent and I agree on this. He's in favor of abolition of the death tax altogether. 400 acres is not a lot of acres to own. 400 acres at $3,000 an acre. Amount, and of course, that's a pretty good price for farmland, and that's good farmland. But nonetheless, that's $1.2 million. That's well in excess of the current exemption, and in a good many cases would provide at the 55% rate that son or daughter or a combination thereof would have to sell a portion of the farmland that's been owned in their family for generations to be able to pay the estate tax. Same way with the person who owns the Royal Donut over in Danville, a couple of Royal Donut shops. The business may be worth a couple $1 million. It's now you're not going to go out and sell it because you have to make a living doing that when you pass away and leave it to your children to run, who've been running the business with you for generations. You got to pay a pretty high tax. Now, sure, so one proposal would be to increase the level at which the taxes kicks in, but I would suggest that on balance, it probably is a better approach to abolish the tax altogether. That's something, one of the few things, actually, that my opponent and I have agreed on. But I understand the point, and it certainly would be, in the absence of complete abolition, one compromise that people have proposed.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have somebody here on a car phone, so we'll not make them wait. We'll get right to them. It's line 4. Hello.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a farmer, and I'm really glad to hear you're addressing the inheritance tax, both you and your opponent. I think that one of the problems is most of us live poor, die rich because in our heirs, just because we can't afford high-powered attorneys, we can't get around it like some of the people with 50, 60 million can. But my question is concerning the national debt reduction. If we take the Social Security Trust out of the equation, we still have a pretty big deficit.
You mean a pretty big surplus?
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're in that. But our problem is, when we're talking about the budget, I really don't like Governor Bush's idea that we give tax cuts to everybody. I prefer to pay down the national debt. Can you address what you think?
I agree, and this is one area where Governor Bush and I don't agree. I'm Tim Johnson running for Congress, not George Bush's surrogate. I support Governor Bush, but I have my own proposals, as I do with prescription medication. You're a farmer?
Yes, I am, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
If I ran my business like our government does, depending on Social Security, to bail the whole system out, I'm broke tomorrow.
No, you're right. Let me address strictly the question you asked rather than generally with respect to agriculture. I've obviously been endorsed by all the farm organizations in the state. I've already had a commitment from the speaker that he'll appoint me to the Ag Committee. I've served in the Ag Committee. I have my own farming operation. Agriculture is hugely important to me. I don't have to tell you that. I think I know your voice, and we know each other anyway. So with respect to the national debt, the national debt and the budget surplus, here's my approach. First thing you do with what is now a substantial budget surplus is to set aside Medicare and Social Security in a lockbox. The next thing we got to do, as you correctly point out, and this is an area where my opponent and I substantially disagree, is I believe somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of the balance, where obviously we set aside Medicare and its progeny and Social Security first, ought to be used to pay down the national debt so we're not continuing to mortgage our children and grandchildren's future. With the balance, I think either the Gore extreme of, I don't know how many, I don't want to use his own proclivity to exaggerate, but the dozens and dozens of new proposals of these programs, new spending programs, I think we ought to avoid that extreme. And at the same time, I think we ought to avoid the extreme that has been expressed by some on the other side that would provide an endless number of new tax cuts, because what's today's surplus could be tomorrow's deficit. And once we lock ourselves into a situation of creating 60 new programs or 60 new tax cuts, then we're locked in. And then when there is, as I hope there's not, a downturn in the economy, we face a potential deficit. We're not able to pay our national debt. And we face a generally fiscally untenable situation. And so I think your approach is absolutely 100% on point and 100% coincident with mine.
Well, I hope other people hear that. Can I make one more point, David?
Sure.
Recently, you were endorsed by the Pantograph.
And today by the Tribune.
Well, this is, I do have a bone of contention with the editorial with the Pantograph. They can endorse whoever they want, but the problem I see with that endorsement was that it was almost backhanded. They said that the reason people should vote for you is that you can bring more clout from if we have a Republican majority and Dennis Hastert and that. And that was basically the only reason. I really believe you vote for the person who does the best job for our district. I don't care who he is.
Well,
and I'm independent in that regard. I don't think that we should tie in that the only reason we vote for a candidate is because if the election goes in other parts of the nation as they think it goes, we should vote for that one candidate. I'd rather vote for the man,
the woman.
Get off the phone. So,
well, let me just address before you either get off or you'll listen to this that. I obviously am gratified by the endorsement of the Pantograph and the Tribune, but I will say that in their endorsement, not only did they talk about the Hastert issue, they also talked about my position on issues, and they also talked about the fact that I have 24 years experience in government and that my opponent has none, and that was part of the basis for their endorsement. So while they did mention the issue of my ability to deal with Hastert, which I don't think is irrelevant given the fact that he's from Illinois and has some sensitivity to the 15th District, in fact, is going to be here Sunday on my behalf. The endorsement was based on a number of things. Today, by the way, being a farmer, today's endorsement by the Chicago Tribune focused largely on my sensitivity to and my commitment to agricultural issues and in particular free trade issues, PNTR and otherwise. So while I don't disagree that the person ought to vote for a person as a person, I believe that the Pantograph editorial was one that extended a little just beyond what the caller said.
Well, I'll let you go, but I do disagree that I vote for the man regardless of what he – I think the person represents our district is much more important than the periphery.
I agree, and I'm hopeful that your vote, if I receive it, will be based on the fact that you think I have the position on the issues and the experience and qualifications to do the job.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. We're here at the point where we have about 12 or 13 or 14 minutes left, and our guest is Tim Johnson. He's a Republican candidate for Congress in the 15th District in Illinois. And if you have questions, give us a call, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL.
I will give not an advertisement, but a simple statement that after I swim my length, I'm going to be over at the Quad, the south end of the Quad, from little afternoon until 12:15, 12:30 to talk to students and faculty and others. I would welcome anybody to be there, including those who are my opponents. I'd love to hear from my opponents as well as my supporters.
Since we just heard from somebody who was involved in farming, let me ask you about freedom to farm. It seemed that certainly for a long, long time, one of the things you heard from farmers was that the government was just too much involved in agriculture, and if the government would just get out, we would be much better off. Some years ago, there was this package of legislation that was enacted that was known as Freedom to Farm, which seemed to do what people in agriculture had been asking for a long time. Then we had a downturn in the farm economy. Farmers have been facing some very tough times, and some people have now said maybe Freedom to Farm was not the right approach and have suggested, well, maybe indeed the government should get more involved in agriculture, at least to the extent that it's there to provide some support for farmers when you get these downticks. What do you think about Freedom to Farm, and does it need to be revisited?
Yeah. Can I not only address that, but maybe expand a little bit to talk about agriculture generally?
Sure.
Because it's a good question. Freedom to Farm passed in 1996. Any farmer would tell you it's a great concept. You know, let the market dictate. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is it hasn't worked as well in a manner that we expected it would. Some people have fallen through the safety net. It has become clear that without a government involvement, many farmers who haven't, and some have, would have gone out of business. So when we revisit that in 2002, and that's when Freedom to Farm sunsets, Tom Ewing has made this very clear to me, Ed Madigan before him, although he wasn't directly involved in Freedom to Farm. It's going to be probably the most complex issue we face in my first term in the General Assembly. While I believe in the fundamental concepts of Freedom to Farm, I believe there are clearly some nuances, if not some major segments, of that concept that need to be revisited, revised, and reformulated. Should government be involved or not involved in agriculture? Yes. Should it? There's areas where it shouldn't be involved. I would have supported, and this is an area of contrast between my opponent and I, a respectful disagreement, I would have supported permanent normalized trade relations with China. I support the same extension of trading rights to China, Vietnam, and so forth. I believe that the best way to deal with human rights abuses is across a diplomatic, through diplomatic means and through other means, through trade negotiations. But I believe free trade is part of the answer to our problems with respect to agriculture. So government doesn't need to be involved, and it shouldn't provide trade sanctions and embargoes where they have in the past. I think they can be involved and should be involved on the income side of the ledger with respect to renewable energy sources such as biodiesel and, in particular, ethanol. I think one of the things the government needs to do, for example, is to ban MTBE. The Pantograph asked me in their editorial session what would be the first bill I put in. And I guess there's a number on my list, but high on my list would be legislation parallel to the Ewing bill to ban MTBE, which is a water-polluting substance that competes with ethanol and is generally not good for either the environment or our national energy program to the extent we have one. And so given the fact that only 1% of all the motor fuel sold in the United States is ethanol, programs to enhance the use of ethanol as part of our energy program, at the same time benefiting farmers, I think is a critical arena of federal and state government intervention.
Just touching on the energy issue, it's an issue certainly that has come up in the presidential campaign, particularly this question of the dependence that we have on oil, a lot of it imported. And that's where we get into questions of should we be doing more exploration in the United States? Should we drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and so forth? And I think that the people who argue against that say, well, that's all well and good, but we really ought to be thinking in much longer term and doing what we can to reduce our dependence on oil, no matter where it comes from. Should the government be somehow involved in promoting alternative sources of energy, energy conservation, efficiency, all that sort of stuff, in addition to continuing to look for oil on U.S. territory?
Absolutely, yes, 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 in regard to all those questions. Mm-hmm. I think we've got to, first of all, we've got to have, David, a national energy policy. We have no national energy mm-hmm. policy. If somebody to ask Bill Clinton what our national energy policy was, he'd say, well, it's whatever I decide it's going to be next week. We have no policy. I would suggest that the revenue arena, particularly state sales tax, federal taxes on motor fuel are something that need to be visited. Rick Winkle and I, Stan Weaver, were involved in the abolition of the temporary abolition anyway, the sales tax on motor fuel at a state level, and I think that's important. I think we need to look, as we suggested a little bit ago, with respect to other arenas at big oil and possible tying agreements and antitrust regulations, violations there. But we also need to be sensitive to encouraging the use of alternative, clean, renewable fuels. And that obviously involves ethanol and so forth. We also need to be very sensitive to conservation and the environment as it fits into our national energy policy. I believe we've got to explore every potential for reducing dependence on foreign oil. But at the same time, as I said in an interview on WGLT not long ago over in Bloomington, while I support examining, for example, the Alaskan arena and looking to see what potential there is for extracting oil that can be sold here, driving prices down, we've also got to be sensitive at the same time to what the environmental effects are or may be in doing that. That's our last frontier, and we don't want to lose it. So I'm not trying to get the best of both worlds, but I am suggesting that there is no simple solution, and it's one that needs to be made with education, which is a point that I want to make across the board. The University of Illinois is a center of research in diverse areas that are mind-boggling, not the least of which is biotech, not the least of which is engineering, not the least of which is the environment, quote-unquote. And many of these issues we deal with, whether they're genetically modified organisms, whether they're environmental impacts or otherwise, can be best addressed with full knowledge. And if we don't have an educated either citizenry or an educated government with respect to these various areas, then we are going to go into negotiations and go into making policy with one hand tied behind our back. So this university, and for that matter other institutions as well, can serve with appropriate federal dollars for research as the flagship or the flagships throughout this area of providing the technological and research basis for the new millennium.
Here's another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was wondering why I hear that you have produced children who were conceived or and or born outside of marriage. I find that News Gazette reports about Mr. Clinton's hanky-panky, but I'm here from multiple sources, including people who claim to be friends of yours, that this is the case. Can you talk about that?
I have no idea what the caller's talking about. I don't know what the caller's calling in about, but that's an insulting question to receive on the air.
Well,
I'm not going to respond. I'm not going to respond to that or any other questions with regard to that kind of area. I'm sorry.
That there's a child of yours who are supporting through the University of Illinois?
That's ridiculous.
I
have no children that I'm receiving any scholarships from the University of Illinois.
No,
I have children at
a variety
of institutions, but to ask those sorts of questions on this sort of forum or any other forum is absolutely ridiculous.
No, that you are paying child support and putting the child through the University of Illinois.
I have no idea, ma'am, what you're alluding to. I certainly have a daughter at the University of Illinois that I'm providing, lives at my home, and that goes to the University of Illinois. I have one son who was at ISU, one son who was at EIU, and a variety of others. But those sorts of questions are so inappropriate that it's insulting to you and the listeners and to me.
No, I think that if we're going to hold the president to one standard, that we should also ask other candidates, that we should have the same standards, and people should talk about their children.
You can continue to talk about them, ma'am. I've given you the answer that I can give you.
I'd also like to know why you have been so insulting to gays and lesbians who've come to protest your stands or anti-gay stands legislatively.
I haven't been insulting to gays or lesbians.
Well, you mocked them when they went and protested when you were speaking in a rural town south of here.
That is absolutely untrue, ma'am.
Well, that's why it was reported.
You've apparently decided that this is going to be a forum for conducting some kind of a personal attack on me based on either total untruths or distortions. And unfortunately, I'm not going to play into the process of answering your questions. I have not insulted gays or lesbians here or anybody else. I happen not to support the inclusion of sexual orientation into our Civil Rights Act, but I apparently a number of my colleagues agree, or that would have been the law in Illinois already. And so I have not been insulting or mocking to anyone of that orientation whatsoever.
Well, that's the way it was reported in the news.
Well, it may have been reported. I don't think it was. I'd like to see the reportage as well as anything else you want to provide me. But this call is obviously one that that I guess we have to subject ourselves to as public servants and as candidates. But it is offensive to me, and I think would be offensive to anybody calling. You produce one person who comes in that says that I mocked gays or lesbians anywhere, and I'll apologize to you.
Okay.
All right. I want to ask one more question before we find ourselves out of time. Your opponent has been very critical of you on the issue of guns and laws about gun ownership, regulation, and so forth. Let me ask the question this way. In what way do you think that it's appropriate for government to regulate gun ownership?
A number of areas. I helped develop sponsor the instant background check system in Illinois that we have now in place. I was a supporter and perhaps a sponsor of the 15 and 20 life bill that enhanced penalties for people who used a gun in the course of the commission of a crime. I support federal law that provides for instant background check across the board from dealers at gun shows or elsewhere. I support Project Exile, which provides for an expansion of benefits, not benefits, but payments to U.S. attorney's offices and ATF and so forth with respect to enforcement of existing laws. I support a number of measures that would crack down on gun violence. That said, I don't support the abolition of the Second Amendment. There have certainly been some proposals that have been made throughout this process that that would chip away at or abolish the Second Amendment. I certainly don't support those measures.
Well, we will leave it at that and say thanks very much.
Thank you for letting me be here. I enjoyed it.
Tim Johnson, Republican candidate for Congress in Illinois' 15th District.